You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Lucy McCann.
Welcome to our second episode in our series marking International Women's Day on Gender at the Bar, with me, Lucy McCann.
And me, Kieran Bahe.
It'll come as no surprise to our listeners that by far the biggest issue discussed by our guests was children, pregnancy, parental leave, childcare, and family life in general. So for that reason, we've decided to dedicate a whole episode to this.
Overall, a far greater proportion of female barristers are primary carers for children. Around 40% of female barristers compared to around 21% of male barristers. And women are usually the people to carry a pregnancy and, if they choose to, breastfeed, which is sadly not a job that they can generally share with a male partner.
But it's true that parenting shouldn't just be a woman's issue. Thinking about the bar's approach to parenting of course affects all those who have to adopt or look after children, as well as those who care for other family members such as elderly parents. And thinking about the impact of long periods of parental leave can, of course, spill over into wider thinking on better accommodating those at the bar who need to take periods away from work for a whole host of reasons, such as health and bereavement.
As in our previous episode, we wanted to start off today's episode with an anecdote which serves as a reminder of how far the bar has progressed in quite a short space of time.
I had an experience as a pupil where a well-meaning member of the bar gave me so-called advice that if I intended to have children, that I should keep quiet about that. And I just thought intuitively that that wasn't right and that attitudes needed to change. And so I from the outset of my career, tried to do something to change those sorts of views. And I think they have changed. I think people would be really surprised to hear that that was advice that I was given 26, 27 years ago.
I was going to say it just shows how far we've come, because hearing that just seems so shocking.
Listeners won't be surprised to hear that the take home of this episode isn't going to be don't have children, or if you do want them, keep quiet.
Yeah, I think that would make for quite a short episode.
Yeah, happily, I suspect the vast majority of those at the bar no longer have those views. But saying that, having children is clearly still the major obstacle to achieving gender equality at the bar. And in this episode, we want to unpack exactly why that is and what members of the bar, clerks, chambers, partners and others can do to make a difference.
We thought we'd start this episode by thinking about pregnancy and parental leave. First up, Emma Louise Fenlon spoke about this when asked about the extent to which being a woman affected her ability to do her job as a barrister.
So a year ago, I would have answered this question by saying, really not at all. My gender hadn't, or at least I felt my gender hadn't affected my ability. And then you reach the world of pregnancy and maternity leave and coming back to work as a primary carer. And it does really feel like the land that feminism forgot. And so I think at my stage, which is fairly early on in my career, I am aware that by having children, there will be an impact. And that's an impact on my career that I'm very happy to take. But you can't not notice that the impact is not so keenly felt by your male peers. And some of that is biological, you know, recovering from pregnancy and childbirth takes time, but some of it isn't biological. It's societal and structural. I think the difficulty is if you are breastfeeding, as lots of women want to do, it makes it very difficult then, I think, to be traveling as often as you might have before you had a baby. And I think getting home in time for bath time and spending some time with your children is also something that doesn't quite gel with court timetables and the expectations of litigation. So I think in terms of the effect it has on caregivers, I'll say that generally and gender neutrally, I think there is a period of time following childbirth and becoming a parent, where I think lots of barristers, men and women, have to think about how they might reorient their practice in order to make it a little bit more child friendly. But I'm pretty confident in saying that the vast majority of that burden is on women.
Next up, we heard from Isabel McArdle about her experience taking maternity leave.
So I've had 3 kids, and that has meant in total I have been out of work for about a year, which is actually fairly small, a fairly short period of time compared to probably the average barrister, female barrister, who's had 3 kids. I deliberately took very short leaves of about 3 to 4 months each time. And don't get me wrong, I know that's not going to work for a lot of people, but it worked for me. So I think it must be the case that having taken about a year out of the 15 or so, 15 coming up to 16 this year, that I must to some extent have missed opportunities and have slowed down a little bit. But I think by taking a year in 3 fairly bite-sized chunks, the impact has been much less than if I'd taken a year for each of them, or even 6 months for each of them. Because it was a bit like going away on a long trial, so I was never away for all that long.
It's unavoidable that long periods of leave, whether that be maternity, paternity, or any other type of leave, do have a direct impact on careers at the bar. And unlike other legal professionals, at the bar this is really significant because most barristers are self-employed, as we heard from Cara Guthrie. And it's also one thing that people may not realise is that, for example, as self-employed practitioners, we don't have, for example, maternity leave and those kinds of benefits that one might get if they're at a company or a law firm or something along those lines.
That's true. I think things have improved in some ways, but certainly I was very aware when I did take some time off having my children that I didn't want to lose all the cases I was working on and come back to an empty diary. And I'm sure that was a feature in my decision to take off what some people might regard as not very long. And then there's the financial aspect. Certainly, you know, if you're not working, you're not earning. I think I, and this was a very long time ago, but I qualified for the maternity allowance, and I think it was £115 a week.
Yes, so probably not a great deal that one can do with that.
Depending on one's areas of practice, it may not necessarily be the case that your earnings completely dry up. Sometimes barristers can live off deferred income, called age debt, whilst on leave. But that period of earning nothing will inevitably catch up with you and will affect earnings relative to those who haven't had to look after children or haven't had children. And this could leave you financially exposed.
And that's before you even start thinking about the extra costs of childcare.
Right, exactly. So let's briefly consider the law on this. Pregnancy and maternity is a protected characteristic under the Equality Act, and this includes self-employed barristers who shouldn't suffer a disadvantage because of their pregnancy. So, chamber support may include considering the impact of travelling on the barrister and allocating cases on that basis, supporting the barrister to speak to the judge to request time to rest or to sit in court, and accommodating medical and antenatal appointments, and that includes partners attending as well.
The Bar Standards Board does have equality rules on parental leave, and their guidance includes that chambers should support barristers to communicate with clients or solicitors in advance of maternity and parental leave, letting them know that they will be away for a period, updating them on the cover in place, and giving some indication of their anticipated return date, although this of course may change. Chambers may also put in place financial policies regarding rent or contribution charges and other chambers' expenses. So it's always worth remembering these safeguards if and when you're considering having a baby and talking to chambers about what they will do to support you.
Yeah, Kieran, I guess it's not necessarily the case that all chambers will be proactive with lots of these measures. So it is really important before you're in that position to take stock on what might be available to you and also what chambers could do in addition to what they're already doing to help you even more. So I think that's a good reason why we should have these kinds of conversations, because lots of these things don't come intuitively or you might not think about, but could really help you if you're having maybe a particularly difficult pregnancy compared to previous ones, or if you just need more time away.
Absolutely.
Great. So we've discussed periods of leave. Let's now turn to think about returning to work after long periods of leave and rebuilding your practice. First, let's hear from Isabel McArdle on this.
The clerks were brilliant when I came back. They notified all my solicitors that I was back. But how much attention can any person really pay to an email saying Isabel McArdle has come back? When you've got, you know, 30, 40, 50 emails a day coming in, we're all human. I think a lot of people just didn't take in that information when I came back. So I made particular effort to get myself out to in-person conferences and social events with solicitors so that they had a visual reminder and sometimes a conversation with me. So it was more obvious that I was back and very much ready for business than if I just let emails alone notifying them be the way that I let them know that I was back. So I think that that has really helped me, and probably one of the reasons why I feel like I have suffered relatively little in the way of negative effects from having been a woman who's had kids is because of that decision to take those short periods. But I know that doesn't work for everybody. I was lucky. I had easy pregnancies. We found it easy to get our children to sleep at night. It isn't going to work for everyone. And I think we have to be realistic that a lot more probably can be done to help the average person returning from parental leave, certainly who's taken any more than a handful of months, because at that point you start to be, I guess, more forgotten about and more needs to be done. But I think a really good idea is in your first month or two back to try to get yourself to be speaking at big events where there's going to be lots of people who know you. It's an incredibly effective way of saying, look at me, I'm back, don't forget about me, please send me more work. And I found that to be pretty effective. And because I only took short periods, a lot of my cases didn't even leave my desk, because if I'm away for 3 or 4 months, in our line of work, in many cases, nothing really happens, or someone can come in and do some discrete task on it, and then I can be back and I can do the trial when I get back. So it worked very well for me, but I'm really aware that I was very lucky to be in a position where I felt able to do that. My husband took quite a lot of parental leave as well, and that inevitably supported me, meant I was in really good shape. By the time I was able to come back, I wasn't exhausted, I wasn't unwell. So it's always a difficult balance, I think, between how much time you want to take out of your career if you're wanting to go back to it, and of course, how much time you want to spend with your baby, because you don't get that time back. But for me, that worked, and I was very happy with that balance. But I think probably a lot of people would see that as quite a brutal sort of way of doing things. You know, I was really not very far after giving birth that I was going back to work, and you know, I probably was quite tired, and I probably was still quite sort of nutrient deficient and all that. But it was also very nice for me, because I felt like myself again, going back to work and being able to, you know, see my solicitors, appear in court, feel like, yeah, I hadn't lost my touch. I was still very much the same person, but there was just a new side to me at this point because I was a mother as well.
And Judith had a similarly positive experience.
18 months ago, my daughter was born, and 6 months ago, I came back to work and have been working very differently now because obviously I've got extra responsibilities and different priorities. But I've been really heartened that, you know, I'm doing the same sort of work, perhaps not as much as I was before I had a baby at home, but I'm still doing the same sort of work, enjoying it. And everyone in Chambers has been very supportive. It was made very clear to me when I came back that you should, you know, not rush back into things and, you know, work out a plan. And that's what I did. I sat down with the clerks and we came up with a strategy of how I'd come back to work, you know, how things would be a bit different. And we've done that, we've stuck to it, and so far it's worked out well.
So this got us thinking, aside from being supportive and getting in touch with clients on your return, what else can Chambers do?
So we had a look at some ideas put out by the Bar Standards Board for some inspiration.
Chambers should try and return reallocated briefs to you on your return from leave where possible. But another positive action measure that I came across was where if a tenant had taken 6 months or more parental leave, they would be offered one in every three appropriate unallocated briefs, which came into chambers for a 3 month period.
Yeah, that is interesting, actually. Other ideas that we came across are, as mentioned earlier, reductions in rent and contribution charges, for example, on a person's return. Chambers should be proactive with practice development, so considering upcoming marketing opportunities, encouraging people who've returned, for example, to speak at events and those kinds of things, and just in general help to build confidence.
And actually, our last episode got me thinking. In our interview with Lady Justice Whipple, she emphasised the importance of data. And so I think it's really important that chambers do collect data on members earning after periods of leave so they can do a sort of comparative analysis. I think it would probably be of huge benefit to those thinking of taking extended periods of leave for whatever reason, so they can at least make an informed decision, or at least go into that leave better informed about how exactly it might affect their earnings.
And as we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, these kinds of practices and policies, whilst having immediate benefit to those who are pregnant and take maternity leave, also benefit partners who want to take time off, those who need time off if they're adopting, and more broadly, those who may need time off for health reasons or for other types of caregiving.
Next, we want to consider how compatible the bar is with family life and children in general, once they're at school or nursery and once you've settled back into work. First on this, we heard from Emma-Louise Fenelon on childcare responsibility.
I think things are improving. Certainly, I'm very encouraged by the way in which when we talk about when we're going to plan meetings, for example, in chambers, lots of people, men and women, pipe up and say, well, I can't do that. I've got to get back for bath time. I think that's a fairly new development, that people feel confident enough that they can indicate publicly that they are balancing priorities and that getting something done professionally isn't always the priority. But I certainly think that decision about whether or not to have children and when to have them, how many to have them, and how that is all planned or not planned, as the case may be, can and will affect one's ability to progress your career.
And is your experience, Emma, and the experiences of the people you know around you, that it is still women that bear the brunt of carrying out childcare? So, for example, other couples that you know, or where both of them do professional jobs, is your experience that it still tends to be the woman in the relationship that tends to do the majority? And that's also assuming that there are two people in that relationship, which obviously isn't always the case.
Of course, and it also assumes that it's heteronormative, which it might not be. I don't know what the up-to-date statistics are. I think they used to be pretty grim in terms of that burden sharing. And I think there are lots of women at the bar who are the breadwinners and have a different setup.
We also heard from Isabel McArdle about how gendered assumptions about childcare affected her once she returned to practice.
I think it doesn't help that the inbuilt assumption often is that we are the ones who are going to be taking more time away, that we're the ones who are going to be turning down more projects and so forth because of the fact that we are women. But of course, it is the case that inevitably having kids has interrupted my working life every now and then when there's a need for one of them to be rushed to A&E or somebody's at home and vomiting. you just have to arrange your life. But as best as we can as a couple, we try to manage those things as fairly as possible. And I guess one top tip I would give to women out there at the bar who are thinking of having a baby in the near future is I have given the school my husband's mobile number as the emergency contact. So every time there are heads banged in the playground or a knee gets scraped, he's the one that gets the phone call. So just small things like that, I think, to some extent can help to redress the balance of it being assumed by perfectly well-intentioned people that the woman is the first port of call when something's gone wrong and she should give everything up in the moment in order to deal with the crisis, rather than it being a more equally shared thing.
Cara and Judith also talked about the practicalities of managing the job alongside raising children. And Cara talked about how it has affected the choices that she has made.
I suppose what I'd say is that being a woman has affected the way in which I have chosen to be a barrister and the area in which I practice. And it's not even so much being a woman, because before I had children, I could do whatever I wanted whenever I wanted. It's the fact that I do have children and I'm married to a man who works very hard too.
It still remains the case for many people that women do tend to do the majority of childcare, and the bar is no exception to that, is it?
That's right. Funnily enough, I think that because we can be flexible a lot of the time, maybe that means that we do tend to take on even more, perhaps, than women who are in a relationship where both parents have to go out to an office or are simply unavailable between set hours. The fact that I can make myself available often means that there's kind of an assumption that I will be able to next week, as it were.
Yes, and I think one of the things about the flexibility as well that we haven't touched on, but actually does take up a lot of time and management, is that kind of diary and time management side of things is a huge burden. Whereas, for example, if you know every day, 9 to 5, you're going to be somewhere, you don't have to spend that much time thinking, well, actually, on Monday, I'll be available between 3 and 4, but then not at 4:30. And then on Tuesday, I'm around at 11 till 1:30, but then I've got to go for a con at 3. And there's actually quite a lot of work that goes into managing a very flexible diary. And that takes a lot of time in itself, as well as doing the actual job, I find.
Me too. You know, there's the phrase, isn't there, the mental load, and managing my own time is as much a part of that as managing everyone else's diaries in their family.
And it's something that we discussed with another barrister we were talking to earlier, Cara, about the kind of double-edged nature of that flexibility that mm-hmm. we have. So on the one hand, as you say, it's easier to fit, for example, childcare around yeah. your working hours. But I suppose the flip side is that things can come in very last minute, or there's an expectation that you can turn stuff around mm. and you can't say, well, you know, I don't work on this time or that time necessarily. I mean, what's your experience been of the kind of maybe negative side of that flexibility?
I've only been back since just under 6 months. So far, I haven't really had a negative experience because I sort of set boundaries and I've stuck to them. And I'm lucky that, you know, at the moment, the way childcare works for our family is that we work around my husband and I when we're available, and each block out our diaries so that there's always one of us who's around. That's not going to be like that forever, and we'll, you know, have to reorganise when our daughter starts nursery and so on. But I think that's been the key for me is, again, like I said, when I was ill, I felt bad about saying I can't do that. But I've learned that sometimes you have to say no if you've got other things going on. But equally, I found that, you know, solicitors on the whole are really accommodating. Obviously, sometimes things are urgent and need to be done and you have to say, I'm really sorry, I can't do that. Someone else will have to cover it. But on the whole, I found that people are willing to be, you know, flexible as well insofar as is possible.
Do you find that it helps that, for example, your instructing solicitors are probably often in the same position as you in terms of they've got their own childcare commitments to balance, and so they kind of get where you're coming from?
I know that that's certainly the case when I've spoken to solicitors about, you know, how long have we got to do this conference and things like that. I think on the whole, most people are understanding and empathetic, and even people who don't have children, you know, people have other responsibilities and other commitments. And I'm sure it's not always been that way, but I think increasingly people are willing to recognise that people have other things in their lives that they have to do. In our job, sometimes things are urgent and you do have to stay up late, get up early and work on the weekends. That's unavoidable. But, you know, so far I found that if you plan carefully and you're honest with people about the reason why you can't do something, 9 times out of 10, it can be accommodated.
One aspect of being able to work flexibly is remote working. And anecdotally, it does seem like people with caregiving responsibilities do benefit disproportionately from remote working. During the COVID pandemic, the bar was forced to embrace technology. For example, e-bundles and remote hearings got us through. And now life at the bar is very different. And for many women and others with caring and competing responsibilities on their time, this has gone some way to mitigate those pressures. We heard from Isabel on this.
I think another obstacle which disproportionately affects women is still, even now post-pandemic, there are, in my opinion, more administrative type hearings happening in person, which could all be done virtually. If I have to get on a train and go to Carlisle for a half an hour hearing, that takes all day and I can't drop the kids off at school and I can't pick them up and I can't be there to make their tea. Whereas if that half an hour hearing happens at 11 o'clock in the morning virtually, then everything else works. And I think that there has been a huge improvement from pre-pandemic to post-pandemic. The amount of virtual hearings has skyrocketed, and that's great. But I still am finding that there is some resistance in some quarters to doing everything that can be done virtually. And it's probably just a matter of time. But I think I should take more positive than negative from that, because we have come on leaps and bounds because of the pandemic making us all convert to virtual and prove that you can even do trials with witness handling virtually if you have to. So we're in a much better situation than we were 5 years ago, but I still think that we could help retain more women who've had children or who have caring responsibilities, and of course others who have those responsibilities too, but disproportionately women, simply by making all administrative hearings that can sensibly be done virtually, which is pretty much all of them.
But as we heard from Sally Smith, Casey, certain practice areas and types of hearing quite reasonably have to remain in person.
Now, I am now going to sound dinosaurian, inevitably one does, because, you know, one's looking back on one's own experience. But when I think of all the early years that I had sort of knocking around county courts, the Domestic Violence Act had just come in and I was going to county courts with sort of battered wives, as they were so called. I can't see Zoom or electronic device of whatever kind being a satisfactory substitute for that from the client's point of view. It may be from the bar and the judiciary, but in the end, you know, if you're a very, very unhappy lady with a black eye who's going for an ex parte injunction in Bow County Court first thing on a wet Monday morning, I actually do think having a lawyer there is very important. And, you know, that's another issue. I mean, I'm sure there are many, many hearings which are not as emotionally charged as that. But as I say, I can remember doing an awful lot of emotionally charged work. Kids who are going to get sort of youth custody and this kind of stuff. And, you know, they need someone there, really, I think. I mean, it's like medicine. Yeah. It's part of the job, isn't it, to make people feel cared for.
Other than remote working, we asked Cara what could be done to alleviate the burden on barristers who are the main caregiver.
It is really difficult. And I think a lot of it comes down to how individual families organise their affairs. You know, for the period of your life that you have children, you have to be available to them, and they get ill and they need to be taken to school and they need to be collected from school or whatever after school arrangements you make for them. I don't know about other people, but I certainly regard myself as working in a team with my husband and with it, certainly when the children were little, whoever else I employed to help me look after them, and you had to make it work. But systemically, how you can, I mean, it is really difficult, isn't it? And whenever I see them talking about extending court hours, which on the face of it makes sense, you just think, well, how does that work for someone who has to travel 2 hours to get to that particular court and 2 hours again to get home or stay away overnight? I don't know the answers. I'm quite pleased in a way I don't have to grapple with it, but I don't know how to make it work.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Kieran, I was just going to say, when I'm talking to my more junior colleagues, the advice I always give them is, certainly if I'm talking to someone who's very ambitious, is choose someone who perhaps is less ambitious than you, because the perfect scenario as a female barrister is to have your partner or the parent of your children being willing to pick up the slack when you let them down.
This actually reminds me of an interview with Dinah Rose, Casey, I remember reading when considering becoming a barrister, whose advice to aspiring women barristers was, marry a house husband, a 1950s-style wife, someone to have dinner on the table. Should women steer clear of male barristers then? Marrying a male barrister is a disaster, she quickly responds, still laughing. They'll always think that their cases are more important than yours, and they'll earn too much money and persuade you to give it up or go part-time.
In reality, as well as there being a global short supply of house husbands, it's not financially viable for many couples, and particularly younger couples, I think, to have only one partner work. However, we heard from Clodagh Bradley, Casey, about how we should certainly expect at least honest and fair conversations with our partners about who's going to take on what regarding childcare, and that those expectations should be shared in the workplace.
I think the number one something that needs to be adjusted and is being adjusted, I believe, is parental leave. For there to be true equality between men and women, the burden of caring for others, be those children or other relatives or other loved ones, the load needs to be shared, and it needs to be shared as equally as possible. Historically, in this country, it's always been women that have carried out most of the childcare and have taken the parental leave. For example, when I had my children, my husband got a fortnight off work paid, and that was quite progressive at that point in time, but there was no option for shared parental leave. And that has changed. There is now, you know, a statutory footing for one to share parental leave and pay. And that seems to be alive and well at the bar. I'm seeing it amongst my colleagues, and I'm delighted to see that my male colleagues are taking substantial periods of time off work when their partner is going back to work. And that means that there is greater equality between interruptions to one's career and earning capacity. Because if we're going to ever achieve equality in the top echelons of any profession or walk of life, we need to share that load. And it's not an insignificant period, because it's not just about the first 6 or 12 months of a child's life. It's also about who drops everything when a child is ill or a relative needs to go for a hospital appointment. So the more equal we are in that, the greater the opportunity for career progression on a balanced basis between men and women. And I think the Scandinavian model has a lot to be said for it. Obviously, that's in a totally different environment of tax systems and funding of childcare and so on. But if we had the Scandinavian mindset that we need to share these things equally, given that if it's a male-female couple, the divide of the responsibility ought to be equal between the man and the woman, then I think that we would be able to improve things in the workplace significantly.
I mean, the things you're talking about are kind of society-wide problems, but are there things that chambers can do in terms of caring responsibilities to help particularly women members of chambers, but also their male counterparts who might want to take leave or take on those responsibilities that fall outside their job?
So I think flexible working is vital, and I think it shouldn't be a female-focused thing, because if we want equality, we can't say we, the women, want this extra support. We need it to be a much broader philosophy than that. So everyone should have the right to work flexibly, whether they're male or female, because you're propagating the presumption that a woman should be responsible for the childcare if you're specifically targeting women for providing that flexibility. So I think that that should be available across the board. And I can say that I've always worked flexibly long before COVID, and I had the benefit of going to all of my children's sports days and school plays because I was self-employed, and all I needed to do was pop it in the diary before a conference or court hearing got in there, and then I would be there at the touchline or sitting in the front row embarrassing my children. And my husband didn't have that benefit because he was employed and would be confined to going into the office on a daily basis and didn't have that flexibility in the pre-COVID days. I think we've moved on a lot because of COVID, and the presumption now is that flexible working is the norm. But it is also relevant to things like travel. I know that my own clerks have been fantastic in always consulting me about work that is out of London, because I want to make sure that that tallies with my domestic commitments. And I would always have an arrangement that if my husband was working abroad, as he often did, I wouldn't be traveling, and vice versa, so that one of us would be at home, but we would make sure that that was done on an equal basis, and there wasn't an assumption that I'd always be the one available. Yeah. It would be my husband on alternate occasions. So I think flexibility is really important. And having a good dialogue with your clerks to make sure that they understand what your domestic arrangements are, which ties in with really having good childcare. And childcare is vital to functioning at work as much as it is at home. And if the clerks know that you have to do your nursery pickup by 5 o'clock, then they ought to know that they've got to check with you before booking a 5 o'clock con. Perhaps your partner can do the pickup that day because you might not want to return that brief. So you need to, again, not be assuming things, but to be talking them through. And that does create an extra burden for your clerks. But if it leads to your retention at the bar, then that burden is worth carrying.
I'm sure that many of you listening will agree that we need some fresh thinking on this issue, and it's important to have an open mind about what solutions could work. As we heard from Lady Justice Whipple in our previous episode, the bar can sometimes be quite set in its ways. Surprising for a job where you still have to wear a wig and gown to court. And it's always important to ask whether we really do have to work in a certain way. So we thought we'd end this episode with an interesting suggestion from Isabel McArdle on how working practices could change.
So I think that there are unfortunately certain inbuilt challenges in the profession which are hard to work around when it comes to anyone who needs to be flexible in their working and or take significant periods of time away, but they're not insurmountable. So of course, court deadlines don't move for my convenience. If an expert report has to be finalised and served on a particular date, then broadly it has to be finalised and served on that date, regardless of what's going on in the background. Of course, that's not to say in an emergency situation, extensions can't be achieved. But largely, you have to work to deadlines and those don't really move. So I think that something which I know we're discussing as a chambers and which perhaps will in the future be a bigger part of the bar is flexible working, like not just flexible hours, which from what I've heard from other colleagues who have done that often simply means you do the same amount of work in fewer hours and it's exhausting. But things like job sharing, I know solicitors who've made that very successful. One might work Monday to Wednesday, one might work Thursday and Friday, and they have to be CC'd into all the emails, they have to sort of catch up, but there isn't too much duplication and it allows for a much more meaningful engagement with work while still having the time, the capacity, the energy to deal with caring responsibilities, which still do disproportionately fall on women. So I think if at the bar we could find ways to make job sharing work, and I think that is achievable, then probably that is the future. And that I would hope would help retention of women at the bar, because I understand that at the recruitment level, broadly, things are looking pretty good, pretty equal. But when it comes to the retention level, I was just looking at some statistics for last year for 15 years call, which is essentially me. And it's quite surprising how many more men have been retained than women. So I think job sharing is perhaps an answer to the fairly rigid deadlines that we have in the job.
Yeah, I just think this is a really interesting idea, and I haven't really come across many conversations about this being a possibility. So if any of our listeners are or know of any barristers who do job share, then do get in touch and let us know. I'd be fascinated to hear more of how that works in practice. And also do get in touch more generally if you have any thoughts on the topics we've covered so far in this series, or if you have any innovative ideas about how the bar can better adapt to accommodate those with extra demands on their time.
I found it really, really interesting hearing the different experiences of different women with parenthood and work. Certainly speaking for myself, I would like to have children and I do think about how that will play out in the future. And I think it's quite easy to think that everything is always getting better, but I was reading a piece in the newspaper recently that I found quite striking, and it linked to some statistics which demonstrated that at least, so these were in the Times in June of 2022. And I think given that the world hasn't changed sort of economically really since then, if anything, it's probably got worse. Yeah,
definitely
I imagine
worse.
I imagine the statistics are still relevant. And it basically said that In the past few months, the number of economically inactive women had started to increase. So 25% of women aged between 16 to 64 were not seeking work versus 17.7% of men. But more strikingly, about 28.5% of economically inactive women were not working in order to look after the home or the family, compared with 6.9% of men. And the number of women who didn't work in order to look after their family has risen by 5% in the past year. And that was the first sustained increase in 30 years, which I found, yes, quite shocking. And the reasons given in the piece for that were essentially the rising costs of childcare and a lot of people finding that essentially it was cheaper to not work because either all of their income was going on paying for childcare or their income was lower than the costs of childcare. So it's cheaper to look after their children themselves. And I think it must be true that for some barristers, that calculation probably does work out that way, whether it's because, you know, they work in a particular practice area where earnings are not particularly high. So it might be criminal bar and you do a lot of publicly funded work, for example. And it also might be because the area where they live is very expensive. And again, you know, there's lots of barristers in, well, mainly centered around cities, which tend to be more expensive places to live. But it's also where we have to live for our work. So I think, yeah, it's really important, really highlighted me that we can't be complacent about this and we can't just assume that everything will get better because it may not. And also, I think finally, to also not assume that we're immune as the bar from any of the wider issues that are going on in, you know, in society and in the economy generally.
Yeah, I know that the government recently have changed the rules on childcare support to try and make more people eligible for more free childcare. But I just don't think that touches the sides, honestly. And I think if you're faced with having to pay for, I don't know, 20 plus hours of childcare a week, either in a nursery or for a nanny or whatever, yeah, it might just be more financially viable for you to just stop working altogether, which is just wild.
I think that really provides some food for thought, and it's quite sobering. And with that, we'll say goodbye and thank you for listening. And we hope that you'll join us for our third and final episode on imposter syndrome, confidence, and the importance of networks and communities of women at the bar.
Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Lucy McCann. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.